When I was 11 or 12, one of my favorite places to hang out was Torvald Shopping Center. And you walked in the door and your right-hand side was Steve's Music Store. They had rows upon rows of albums. On every wall danced music posters you could purchase. And behind the cash register were 40 cubicles that featured the top 40 singles of the week. I can still remember looking up and seeing Hey Jude. I must have worn that single to death. I know I'm dating myself because today everybody has 3 million songs in their pocket. But if I can take you back to that store for a moment, I want you to picture that above those albums was a shelf that ran the perimeter of the store. And on that shelf were drum kits, electric guitars, amplifiers, and microphones perched on stands. One day, a purple teardrop electric guitar caught my eye for $60. It included a small amp, and they threw in the guitar case and a strap. Now, $60 was a lot of money, but I managed to save, and one day I brought that beauty home. I had a vibrato arm, and I thought it was the coolest guitar on the planet. I took guitar lessons and worked hard to learn my chords, but my love for music and my musicality were different. But of course, being who I am, I formed a band with two of my friends. We spent 2 days coming up with our name, Electrical Illusion, and dreaming about our fame, and about 2 minutes learning how to play House of the Rising Sun by The Animals and Wild Thing. And I say play with the greatest of generosity. We had one gig playing for our scout troop. Alan Clark was on the drums. Now, he had talent. He went on to play music. I was the lead guitarist, well, the only guitarist. And I won't name the organ player because 5 minutes before our world debut, he got stage fright. John Bolton stepped in at the last minute. Didn't matter what he played. No one could hear a plastic organ with a front speaker over my amp. We had someone flipping the lights on and off. After all, we were the Electrical Illusion. It was undoubtedly one of my greatest memories combined with one of the worst listening experiences for the audience. I don't know what happened to my purple teardrop guitar. Hopefully, it got passed on to someone that could play. But I've always admired musicians, and I must have seen 100 rock documentaries showing the ones that turned their passions into a career. They didn't always end well, as it can be a price to fame. But when they were there as a songwriter, a musician, or a singer, and their music and passion became a gift to others, it's when magic happened. To appreciate what you do and have it appreciated by so many people. My guest today is a trailblazer, the godfather of Canadian hip-hop. His name is Wesley Williams. Fresh West. We know him by his stage name, Maestro Fresh West.
Let your backbone slide. Let it slip, let the rhythm rip while my lyrics leave my lips. Ladies and gentlemen, kids of all ages, drop it, drop it.
You underestimate the intellect of Farley Flex, my rhyme.
It's gonna go.
First offense. All
the mix. And strap yourself in, because this interview, Maestro shares so many wonderful stories about his life, but more importantly, lessons in life.
This jam is amplified, so just glide, glide. And let your backbone slide.
This is Chatter That Matters with Tony Chapman, presented by RBC.
You listen to every word I say, every verb you heard. So, Maestro Fresh West, welcome to Chatter That Matters.
Thanks for having me, sir.
So, the oldest of three children, Guyanese immigrants, what brought your parents to Canada and gave us the blessing of your artistry?
What brought them to Canada? Opportunities. You know, my parents are from, the Caribbean. They thought there'd be more opportunities here in North America, in the wilderness of North America. And my dad chose Toronto, and he's a former graduate of Ryerson. I guess they call Ryerson TMU now. He worked for CN, Canadian Railway, and my mom worked at Bell Canada for over 25 years. And they worked extremely hard, man. So enough respect to my family. I'm the first. Big up to my brother and my sister as well, but I'm the first.
So I love that I was reading about you and you said your world changed at age 11. Your dad drops a needle on the Sugar Hill Gang's Rapper's Delight.
Oh, my goodness.
So tell me about that. Take me back to being 11 years old
And
how it changed everything.
Yeah, when I heard that, I was like, wow, these guys sound cool. It was just something that just was so infectious. And then I heard the breaks from Curtis Blow. And Rapper's Delight was just the most popular song. So we had it all memorized. But there was an artist named Jimmy Spicer who had a song called The Adventures of Super Rhyme. And once I heard that, Tony, I thought I had superpowers. I thought I had superpowers.
And do you think it's something that we all have inside us, or is it just people really gifted with music that can understand things like the breaks and sort of get the nuances and realize that this isn't just something to enjoy, but this is something to truly consume?
Well, I will say there's people who excel in different entities, you know, different things altogether, right? So one of the things with me being a music fan, I might have been good with putting words together. But like to rap took time, to get good at it took time. The first time I ever performed was 1979 at my elementary school, Our Lady of Good Counsel. I was in the sixth grade. I won some poetry contest. It was supposed to be about winter. Matter of fact, it was around this time back then when I was 11. Yeah, like 40, almost, yeah, 7 years ago, what happened. Yeah. And I did it in the cadence of Rapper's Delight. That's the first time I rapped. It was an acapella and the crowd went wild. My teacher looked at me like, what in heaven's name were you doing? I just wanted you to recite it, right? And from that, you know, grade 8, grade 9, and then grade 10 is when things got to the level where I'm performing at my high school for the first time, which was Senator O'Connor. And I did a couple high school jams and people felt like, wow, Wes, this is something you're really good at. And then I had the opportunity to perform at the same place my dad went to university at, which was Ryerson at the time, right? And so I was 15 then. Yeah, I hooked up with, shout out to Ron Nelson. He had a show called The Fantastic Voice Program. I did a couple times with dad. And then there was a contest called the Battle of the Rappers, Tony. This was at Government, which was known as Club Fresh. I don't know who put that on, but I formed a group with a good friend of mine named Marlon Bruce. The group was called Vision, and Battle of the Rappers had almost 30 groups who entered. They picked the top 8 from all over the city. We're talking Brampton, Mississauga, downtown, Scarborough, and I'm proud to say Vision won. And once that happened, that's when things really started to steamroll, because I had the stamp of approval from Ron Nelson on radio that I was nice. But then to get to start doing shows later on, and winning the crowd over amongst everybody in the city who was involved in that. That was a beautiful thing. And that's what helped me propel to like, you know what, this is maybe something I can do one day.
Did you ever watch I remember watching Eminem's sort of biography and he's, you know, Lose Yourself, where he just freezes on stage at the beginning, yeah, right? I mean, that tension moment. Did that ever happen to you where you just got up there and you just said, no, this is where I belong?
Okay. You know why it didn't happen to me? Because my DJ froze. And so did, My partner, Ebony MC, he froze. He couldn't move. Like, I'm all over the place. Like, I'm all over the stage. And I'm like, why is this guy standing still like that? Like, I was left, right. I was just, and the crowd went wild. And then after, I'm like, were you okay? He goes, yeah, I was nervous, man. That's why I couldn't, his feet, he had cement feet. He couldn't move.
You know, it's funny, and this is in so small in comparison to what you're doing, but I remember being in an elementary school play. I was the narrator. It was the Wizard of Oz. And I remember looking out in the audience and seeing my parents beaming and going, wow, I'm making them proud. I just felt like I could float. Did you get that kind of affirmation from your parents that, you know, I mean, these are hardworking. They've come to Canada. They, you know, a lot of immigrants want their kids to be doctors and lawyers and accountants and finding some security. But what did they feel about you deciding that spotlight and microphone was what mattered most?
Well, my dad was the photographer for my first album cover. So when you see the cover of the album, Symphony in Effect, that was shot in the Scarborough basement. We just put a blue backdrop behind it, cropped it. I rented a tuxedo from Tuxedo Royale. I got a cello from Steve's Music or Longa McQuaid, whichever one. Bought a conductor stick and I'm like, okay, quick, dad, take some photos. So he's been supportive as much as he could, all things considered, based on the fact he didn't have a point of reference to look at like that. You see what I'm saying? He just knew that that was something that I liked doing, you know?
You know, when you think about it at that age, you know, everybody's trying to find their place as they're growing up. You know, people are going, that was unbelievable. You know, listening to you in high school and then you're moving on. How did he ever realize that that was going to become more than a hobby or sort of, you know, something I did to get that attention? To really you saying, you know, this is the journey I want to pursue. Did you ever have to have that conversation with him, or was it more, you know what, this guy's got the it factor? I mean,
I think it was the it factor. It was like, you know, there was no point of reference. Everything showed me that I was doing the right thing. But you have stumbling blocks because you're from Toronto, Canada, and there's no points of reference. So how could you be sure? But you don't know. Were you sure that when you stepped on BWIA Airlines to come to Canada, that you would have 100% been successful? You don't know. Like, you took a shot knowing that this is what you want to do for you and your family. And I took a shot at it because I believed in myself, you know, and, you know, like, how cool is it that years later I'm getting inducted in the Canadian Music Hall of Fame? So that, to me, to me, that was something that must have happened. You feel me? Definitely.
And, you know, you and I both went to Carleton. I only got to go for a year, qualifying year. Glengarry was my residence, but you spent time there, but you get a lot of stuff going on.
Same as you. I did there the year.
Yeah.
And then after that, I was like, let me take some time off to work on me. Let me see what I want to do. You know, I think when I seen Eric B and Rakim, the video was I Ain't No Joke. That right there, that was a turning point. When I saw Rakim, I saw myself because I'm like, yo. And when I met him years later in Vancouver and I had a couple of drinks, but I looked at him. I said, look at my face, family. We're brothers. We're brothers. Look at me. I he just looked and started laughing. And what did I say the name of the song was? I Ain't No Joke. So he's no joke, but I made the God laugh. You know, I don't know if he's laughing with me or laughing at me, but shout out to the God MC Rakim. You feel me? So that was a beautiful feeling right there.
So, you know, you talked about your first album, your debut album, Symphony in Effect. That's the one your dad took the picture for. Was there a connection between the name and the album and Maestro? Like, I'm just really interested in how this whole Maestro came along, because to me, that's this impresario curator. This is a synthesizer of culture and energy. So did that all sort of fuse together? Or was that more coincidence?
Nah, fused together because it's like when you look at like MCs, they have three names. LL Cool J. You see what I'm saying? Cool G Rap, right? Big Daddy Kane. It was always three names. So I thought, like, how cool is it? Like the Maestro Fresh West. That's where it came from. And then when I saw that tuxedo at Parkway Mall, I was like, wow. In Scarborough, I'm like, yo, okay. Because it was just going to be Fresh West. Because my rap name used to be Melody MC from about 1982 to about 88. And then when people started calling me old around 1987, that's when I said, you know what, maybe I just changed my name altogether. And that's when I reinvented myself and became the Maestro Fresh West. You see what I'm saying? So I was doing all these things that marketing gurus talk about back then, reinvention and stuff like that. And I knew that the black tuxedo might have been a little too left field for the average B-boy. That's why I created Dope State. That's why I came up with that, you know, something more palatable to the average B-boy, you know, with the red and gold, with the Dope State at the back, groove in the front.
You just have this natural gift for branding and positioning. And like, where did that come from? I mean, I guess that's part of being an artist, right? But I mean, to be able to step outside and look at yourself and say, this is how I want to shape it, is not always that easy.
It's not. I don't know. But these are the things that I was doing before I knew what I was doing. Like, the people write books about this, like branding and cross promotion and trend setting. Like, I just knew that coming out of Canada, you know, you got to be different. You know, it's not just, you can't just be good on the mic. You got to be different. You got to work extra hard. And that's what I really try to do.
Do you think you're dismissed because you're coming out of Canada, that where, you know, the whole culture is happening in the States, they feel you don't have the creds to be on that stage with them? Or does that just make you work harder?
Both. But at the same time, my brother Chuck D from Public Enemy said the mistake he felt that I made was, and not just me, he felt the mistake that I made, as well as a lot of Toronto or Canadian MCs, we were just trying to battle with New York. You see what I'm saying? But you got to, you know, he said, you got to understand, people in New York battle with people in New York. There's other parts of the world too, other parts of the country. You know what I'm saying? I remember him telling me that. Like, he goes, he didn't call that downfall from Toronto MCs. But my logic is, if I feel like I'm just as good or better than anybody, it is what it is. That's rock. You feel me?
Yeah.
But he's absolutely right. There's other territories as well.
So how did Let Your Backbone Slide? I mean, this is where, you know, you go from being, hey, this kid's got talent, to you can write, you can put something together that's going to last. It gets you into a Hall of Fame years later. Like, how did that come about? Did you know it was going to be what it was going to be, or was it just flowed from you? And as Dylan said, sometimes that was a time in my life where magic happened. I don't know how, but you know.
Yeah. Well, I knew Backbone Slide was Let Your Backbone Slide was dope. I knew it, you know, I knew it was conceptually something that was palatable, that was exciting. And, you know, I performed Electric Circus and the legendary dance artist from Florida, Stevie B, just so happened to be in the Much Music building at Electric Circus right when I was performing. He saw me perform. He liked what he heard. He called Mike Williams over and he wanted to meet me. And enough respect to him because he connected us with his label at the time, which was LMR Records. So if it wasn't for Stevie B, I wouldn't have been on LMR Records. We were talking to a company called Eureka Records on BMG, but they just wanted a single deal, you know? So LMR had a bigger budget. And you got to remember, years before that, we were trying to shop our demos to Canadian companies, and they weren't really biting either. So everything happened at the right time, and I'm honored to still be here. But that was the foundation. And Let Your Backbone Slide is the first single from a Canadian hip-hop artist to ever go gold. Platinum.
This is a throwdown, a showdown. Hell no, I can't slow down. It's gonna go.
First offense.
All the mix.
There's a lot of my listeners. I mean, this show is all about chasing, overcoming circumstances and chasing dreams. Talk about that time where you go into the offices of these record companies. They're holding the cards. They decide if there's going to be a deal. What advice can you give to people when they have that shot, when they have an opportunity to kind of break a door down? What do you do so that they know that they're actually listening to somebody that's capable of carrying an audience, of selling records, versus just an artist is just passionate about what they do?
Tony, what I try to do is have universally applicable messages, because not everybody's within the parameters of just music. You know, stuff that I try to do is inspire athletes, you know, people in business, people in different multimedia realms as well. And my slogan is, don't make records, make history. Anybody can make a record, but by making history is when you do something and you say something that resonates intergenerationally. And a lot of time, you got to sharpen that axe and take time sharpening that axe. What I mean by that is, like, I had to take time coming up with the Maestro Fresh West. I had to find it. I had to conceptualize it. You see what I'm saying? After that was in place, now it's the word mad will always rhyme with glad. Always. The rhyme writes itself. You see what I'm saying? Once you put time into to conceptualize whatever it is you're doing, right? That's the things that people try to shortcut. They try to cut corners with that and try to jump into the mix of stuff. I always state.
Do you think that's a problem or a current happening in today's society, is everybody wants to cut corners because it's easy? Hey, I can rap. I got AI now, or I can, you know, like I said, Malcolm Gladwell, 10,000 hours of practice. It seems like people want to do it in 10 hours.
And that's the problem. That's their downfall. And you might make a couple of dollars right now, but it's going to catch up to you because you didn't put that time in and you try to cut corners. And it's just bad business practice. It's not good for your personal or professional development. You know, when I got into acting, I wasn't that good at first, but the transferable skills I learned from hip hop was the importance of repetition will always help your preparation. I had an audition one time and I had a callback and I didn't go to the callback. I didn't rehearse the callback because they liked me before. So when I went into the audition, I saw it was totally new, 13 pages of script, which I never even looked at. And it was the worst audition of all time. My agent even told me, you were horrible. She seen it and she sat me down and said, listen, you have to have the same energy you have with music. You got to have with this right here. So I just wasn't mature enough to know that if you get a callback, they're not calling you back for the same exact lines. It could be something totally different because they saw what you had already, right? But if I stuck to what I learned from hip hop, which was repetition will always help your preparation, I would have been ready because I would have at least looked at it to see that these are 13 brand new pages altogether. You see what I'm saying?
Do you keep that edge even today? I mean, your name carries it, you know, that you part the sea with it. Do you still have that same work ethic that says, you know, if there's a rung out there to grab on, I'm going to have that. I'm going to be prepared.
Indeed. And one of the reasons, I hate to say it, but one of the reasons is COVID. Once COVID hit, it was like, we're scrambling. Artists ain't performing. How are you living? So what I did a lot, I started working with people who needed help the most, which was the youth, right? And I feel that God's rewarding me right now. You know, I put out a children's book, Stick to Your Vision, Young Maestro Goes to School. That was in school systems here in St. John, New Brunswick, as well as in Ontario, what have you. And I did a lot of volunteer work here in the city of St. John. The mayor made me an ambassador of the city. And it's like, I must be doing something right because I feel I'm being rewarded in so many different capacities.
And, you know, finding that gift within COVID, as opposed to just saying, you know, the opportunities, the doors closed and locked away. Because a lot of people just sort of did that. I mean, some people have looked back at the COVID experiencing the greatest thing that ever happened in my life is I had to get on a new tightrope, find it and conquer it. And other people said it was the most horrible experience because I, you know, I was denied any opportunity. Like, what's the difference between someone that makes it happen or just watches and wonders what happened?
Tony, I think you made a great point when we first started a conversation about my parents. My parents, they had to leave, Guyana to come into the wilderness of North America and learn, you know, being first generation, you know, Black Canadians here, you know, first generation, you know, they're from Guyana and having their children being born here. Learning this new land, learning this new territory, learning this new region, way of life. We had nothing to complain about. Nothing, you know, at all. So what? We had a tough time for a minute. But like I said, I concentrated more with youth. I concentrated more of trying to be the best father I could for my son. And I feel I'm being rewarded right now, man. It's like a lot of cool things happening. I got my TV show now, The Maestro Chef West, because I don't make burgers. I make backbone sliders, family. You know what I mean? Yeah. How cool is that? We in season 2. I got Race Against the Tide, season 4 happening on CBC. It's like I'm doing different things. But the foundation of all that was hip hop. And I always implement that same mentality. Don't make records, make history. So when you look back at Race Against the Tide, you'll be like, yo, he was good hosting that, you know, or you look back at Mr. D, you'd be like, yo, Maestro's all right. He's a cool actor. He's funny, or he's dramatic, or he's a good author. You see what I'm saying? Because hip hop was the template and the launching pad for all other things that I'm doing.
How important is that to diversify? Because some people might say, hey, man, you're selling out. Do you ever find that critics have come back to you and said?
Never. Me personally, no, because I mean, musically, you know, I don't know too many MCs who had songs with social commentary before I did. You know what I'm saying? That being said, you know, I grew up watching artists like Tupac do what he did from, you know, making music to acting or Ice Cube or Ice-T, right? So I think it's just a natural progression. I've never had any foolishness like that. Like, you know, me personally, I think there have been criticisms because I was in New York for a while. That's just cause kids over here were younger. They didn't know better. Cause now Drake's living in Calabasas or whatever. No one says anything, but me back in 92, it's like, oh my God. Like, you know, I just think people were young back then. They didn't know better. They were children. And I was an elder statesman doing things that they weren't ready to do yet or comprehend at the time, you know? And I think longevity shows because I'm still here, you know, in one capacity or the other.
Talk to me about a punch in the face and your commentary about Chuck D.
The greatest hip hop album of all time to me is It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back. That's Public Enemy's sophomore album. Came out, I believe, in 1988. And that changed the whole scope of sampling. The art of sampling at its finest. The art of having social commentary in your music and having a message and to inspire your community. I've never seen anything like that before. Other artists, majority of other artists might inspire me to be a better MC. But Chuck D inspired me to be a better human being. You see what I'm saying? How many MCs can you say do that for you to make you want to not just be a better MC, but be a better human being? When I heard It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back, every one of those songs started off with like a punch in the face. And that's what inspired me with Let Your Backbone Slide. So when you look at the very first thing Chuck D said, especially that album, listen to the words. Here it is. Bam. Yes. The rhythm, the rebel. Everything was like a punch in the face. So with me, this is a throwdown, a showdown.
Yeah, I love it. I love this whole fusion and how it's like almost, you know, this artist, it travels like liquid without a dead end. So, you know, you mentioned Drake. I mean, you came out with the song 416-905. And, you know, put Toronto on the map. And next thing you know, Drake's talking about the six. Do you think like Billy Squire might have inspired you, that you were doing stuff like that, that Drake started listening to and realizing that putting a flag on the map, identifying with a region is part of what it all, the journey's all about?
You got to ask him about that. But if you do, he'll tell you that, yeah, I'm one of the people who inspired him as an MC, especially. He's let me know that. That's probably one of his favorite songs, if not the favorite song that from me, for the fact that I'm representing Toronto. That's something I've been doing from time. It's just that he's so much younger than me that he didn't grow up in the era of like Let Your Backbone Slide and stuff like that. He grew up like with the songs that I did like in the late 90s and stuff like that. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I listened to actually a couple of things that he talk, and the tributes he makes to you are unbelievable.
Yeah, Maestro, again, another legend, man. Another guy from our city that broke down a wall and had a song that just went farther than anybody at the time. And then not only that, 416 to the 905 was like, it just was like the first time anyone bigged up like where we were actually from, you know. And it's so funny to see people across the world talking about the six and talking about Toronto like it's a destination, because at that time, making a song called 416 to the 905 was like insane, you know, like no one's even gonna know what you're talking about.
We return my three takeaways, and you'll hear how much I enjoy chatting with the one and only Maestro Fresh West. If I asked you to think about what RBC is doing to support Canadian arts and athletics, chances are you'd land on their high-profile events like the RBC Canadian Open for Golf, the Toronto International Film Festival, the Olympics, and even their upcoming sponsorship at Taylor Swift shows in Canada. And you wouldn't be wrong. But what I think deserves more attention is what RBC's doing to help Canadians chase their dreams and change their world and ours for the better. For example, RBCX First Up. This is a program dedicated to providing emerging Canadian artists with a platform that they can stand on to gain exposure, funding, education, and mentorship opportunities. RBC Training Ground, where they go across country and identify potential Olympic talent, and they provide them the funding they need to chase that podium. For RBC Emerging Artists, supporting organizations that provide the best opportunity to advance an artist's career, and in genres that include visual arts, music, theater, dance, literature, and film. And RBC Community Junior Golf, it's an initiative led by RBC in partnership with Golf Canada that is building greater diversity and equity in golf. How? They provide affordable access for youth from equity-deserving communities across Canada. Yes, RBC will take you inside the ropes at a golf tournament or on the red carpet at TIFF. They'll create compelling behind-the-scenes content at the Olympics and even a chance to see Taylor Swift. But behind the scenes, that's where the true magic happens. Helping everyday Canadians own their podium, find their audience, sink their putt to win the Canadian Open, or even play their music to the biggest stadiums in the world. Arts and athletics? Well, it matters to Canada, to you, to me, and to RBC.
I think when we start with the heart, by understanding that we can all sort of contribute to this great Canadian quilt, this great Canadian landscape, I think we are all the better for it. And when young people are able then to bring themselves to the table, and every skill, every sinew of talent or of fiber that they have to advance issues in areas that are in the best interest of Canada, building sort of that sense of inclusion, I think we are all the better for it as a country.
Those are the words of Mark Beckles. He'll be joining the show after Wes and I wrap up on my three takeaways. Don't miss what he has to say about the future of youth.
You're listening to Chatter That Matters with Tony Chapman, presented by RBC.
My guest today is Maestro Fresh West. He's a walking renaissance man, inducted into the Hall of Fame for his songwriting, gifted artist, author, motivational speaker, and actor. I want to talk to you a little bit about the industry now. It seems that as I'm following it, we talked a little bit about marketing, that today artists no longer want to sing for their supper, like endorsement deals. They want to own the diner. You know, you look at Rihanna, Jay-Z, P. Diddy. I mean, these are people that are now becoming, some of them approaching $1 billion because they decided it's their audience. It's their
right to monetize it versus maybe somebody just coming in and trying to tuck in on their spotlight. That's got to be something that's really a positive thing, don't you think?
Yeah, man. I mean, you got to understand, like, all this is investments. Like, all the stuff that I did with my first couple of albums, those are just investments for me to be where I'm at right now. You see what I'm saying? So I guess with those artists you just mentioned, you know, they might have done a couple of things along the way for their to get them established. Now they're at the level where they're billionaires or striving to be billionaires based on what they've already done. Like, all that sweat equity and putting in, into rhyming, you know what I'm saying? Writing your songs, touring, what have you. You get to a level where it's like, if you're fortunate, and not everyone's like that, but you're fortunate enough to be like, okay, this is my position right now. I'm based on this and the value of this. I'm going to start doing other things as well. So, you know, you got to tip your hat off to artists like that.
And talk to me a little bit about trust. I watch a lot of music documentaries. I watch it. And one of the things that I find is a common chord is that often trust is broken between the artist. And I'm not asking you to name anybody personally, but the people that want to monetize your talent. Did you find that growing up that it's hard to really believe that the people are in your court versus maybe just serving you up for their court?
This is business. You see what I'm saying? If you look at your contract says your label has the right to exploit your music. You know what I'm saying? It's business, right? My whole thing is I'm looking long term. So if I know that as we speak right now, I have potential deals on the table for songs that I own. How cool is that? Knowing that the investment that was made was the stuff that I did in the 80s and 90s. Do you get what I'm saying? So I'm here right now. You have to understand this Hall of Fame induction. This has put me in a level where I'm branded in a way where I can do certain things, what have you. So what I did back then, that was cute. That was just a launching pad for me to be here. Now, I could have fell off and said, you know what, crumble up and I'm not doing that anymore and give up and retire, which would be understandable because a lot of my peers have, you know, and it's understandable because this is a tough game, man. You got to be you got to have thick skin. You got to know when to like remove yourself from certain entities, what have you. But like, this is where I'm at now, man, you know, based on what I've done before. So that being said, I'm not really stressing like label stuff. You don't really hear me. You know, they didn't want to sign me because of my good looks. They signed me because they thought they'd have an opportunity to make some money, right? I signed with them because I thought I'd have an opportunity to make some money from them. So the fact that I'm still here and doing things that's so rare is a good thing. You see what I'm saying? So I don't trip over that.
Interesting. I just had Erica M on my show from the Much Music days. That was an era where we didn't just hear the artists, we saw it. And I look at Let Your Backbone Slide. What a fantastic video that is. The energy, the street, the whole thing. I hope you don't take this wrong, but it was almost like the Music Man. It was like a New York musical happening, except with your music. I mean, that just so much going on. Does that change your ability to hold on to that artist the next time you come out with new music? Because you're trying to get those early adopters to stay with you and to say, hey, I found somebody fresh and I want to keep supporting him. Or do they suddenly, they frame you a certain way that it's hard to move them somewhere else?
Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. Because it's like, this is the point of reference. And that's what they expect from you. And the thing is, there's something called growth, right? And, you know, I realized a long time ago that Chubby Checker, he's known for the twist. So it doesn't matter if you do a Drake remix or a Weekend remix or Party Next Door or whatever. When people see you, they know you're the guy who do the twist. I've been able to have some type of brand maintenance because I wasn't lazy. I worked on acting. I worked on, you know, other entities as well. But I made sure that the foundation of everything I do is hip hop. So there was never been a time when it was like, I'm retired. Nah, how can you retire? You know what I'm saying? I never heard Leonard Cohen say he retired. He just kept making music till he passed away. You know, we're artists. You might take 10 years off, 15 years off, 20 years off, but what we do, we're artists. And that's what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. You know what I'm saying?
So I had Harry Connick Jr. on the show and he, you know, he'll say the same thing. I'm a jazz pianist. That's my roots. And he talked about when he got into acting,
Matthew Broderick, I think, was the actor, just sort of took him under his wing and said, hey, kid, what are you standing over there for? And he goes, what do you mean? He says, stand by me. I'm the highest paid actor. That's where the camera's going to be if you want to become. Did you have anybody, as you got into acting, that kind of took you under your wing and sort of said, let me show you some ropes. Let me tell you how the system works? Or
Tanya Lee Williams.
Really?
Tanya Lee Williams. Yeah, Tanya Lee Williams. People knew her from Polka Dot Door. And then later on as Young and the Restless. And then later on into the Real World Film Festival. But she was one of the first people to put me under her wing and just be like, yo, young gunner, young shooter, my brother, this is what it is. And that's how she was with me, is how I have to be with artists. You see what I'm saying? And with actors anyway, especially. But like how Public Enemy was with me as an MC, as an upcoming MC, is how I have to be with upcoming artists.
And do you have to have a two-way exchange? I mean, you have to be open to listening and growing and taking it all in. I mean, is that part of when you're mentoring somebody, is to say, look, I could help you any which way, but if you're not open to it, we're not going to create that energy.
Yeah, listen, I'll just give you advice for what I know, and I don't want anything. I'm good. Just take this and run with it. You feel me? Just take this and run with it. But one thing I have to mention, and as a part of what you're talking about right now, is I've established the Maestro Fresh West Scholarship. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Let's talk about it.
Yeah, the Maestro Fresh West Scholarship is something that I made for Black youth who are interested in learning trades out of the Nova Scotia Community College's Akerley campus. And the reason I chose that, Tony, is because in 2017, that specific campus gave me an honorary diploma for the impact that they felt that I've made on the province. My book, Stick to Your Vision, was a part of mandatory reading for grade 10 students, which I was excited about. It also became a part of adult learning program. And they felt I must have done something noteworthy. So I figured, you know what, how cool is that to have a scholarship established at that very same college that gave me an honorary diploma back in 2017. So we don't have a shortage of rappers, but we definitely have a shortage of Black youth, and you know, that are involved in trades. And I figure that I've done a great job of building Black music in Canada. So it would be irresponsible of me not to at least try to inspire young Black builders. That's something that I'm excited about, and I'm glad that the NSCC Akerley campus allow me to implement that for the 2020-24 season.
You're getting inducted into the Hall of Fame. You've written children's books. Your adult book has become part of curriculum. You've been a very successful actor, host. I mean, you got lots of going on, and a mentor and a motivational speaker. Like, do you have a sense of what the next 5 years is going to be for you? Or is it just the fact that you've got so many things happening that who you are will just flow?
No, I'm excited about what's going to happen. I just got to stay healthy. That's the main thing. Stay healthy. And my main thing is my fam. I got a 15-year-old son. He likes me catching his rebounds, you know, in the morning when he's training. And I got to stay young. I got to do that, you know. Like, I've learned to embrace what I've accomplished in the past. But, you know, you got to keep it moving. So, but I will say this is something very special. It's never happened before where I'll become the first and only hip-hop artist inducted in the Canadian Music Hall of Fame. I'm very excited about that. That's something I'm going to embrace. That's something that we're going to, you know, celebrate.
Is that going to inspire more music from you? Or
absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. The year I won the two Junos, I was nominated for five. I won for best video. Shout out to Joel Goldberg for doing such a great job on Backbone Slide, as well as Drop the Needle, which I won. Joel Goldberg has been very instrumental in my career. So I won for best video as well as for rap recording of the year. But Tony, I was also nominated for best single of the year, artist of the year, and one other one. But Bryan Adams kicked my butt in all of those. So anyway, I felt good the fact that I won these awards. But at the same time, a gentleman by the name of Leonard Cohen was receiving a Lifetime Achievement Award. So my Juno was maybe a little bigger than this water bottle, but Leonard Cohen's Lifetime Achievement Award, it was like the size of a grand piano. They had to push that on stage. And here I am with my two little water bottles, like, hi guys, right? And watch this. In 2013, I was nominated again for a Juno. And what do I see? Leonard Cohen again, this time for international album. So even after he decimated everybody's life with inspiration, with his lifetime, years and years later, he was still putting out music, still doing things. And that's how I want to be. I just wanted to continue being fun like it is right now for me. So I'm like,